Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
The Mean Team.
With guest co-hosts,
Garrett Sidzaka.
Boizar.
All right, this show has stopped making any sense altogether. You know, you've sunk down as low as the modcast. I'm going to tell you all that right now.
No, see, Dan does some magic editing.
Welcome to episode 77. I'm here, Boizar. As usual, Dan Quick is here.
Back again, whether you like it or not.
Maki.
Needing more caffeine again.
Tony.
Something sexy.
And the Me and Team.
And the Mean Team is our newest regular co-host who helped prevent Imran from being on another episode. Gold star!
I have Imran repellent on. I'm wearing it right now.
Oh, man, he's going to love that when he hears it.
Well, I've yet to actually introduce myself to him, despite being a regular co-host for the second episode now and appearing on the show three times.
The multi-team democracy game that at least me and the team are part of. It's a multiplayer game where there are five teams and numerous players on each team control a civilization each and then play against each other, and it goes over pit boss, so it takes quite some time and there's a lot of discussion between each. But I find it very fun, and anyone who wants can join either my team or one of the other teams.
Under the miscellaneous category, Game Studies, Personality and Gaming Preferences Questionnaire. Then, in the Senate, when do you build your granary in your capital? First Great Spy, what to do with? State property or corporations? Great People Points, overrated or underrated? And questions about drafting. Game Studies, our Personality and Gaming Preferences Questionnaire. Why, I can speak for all of us on the personality geek. Next. Do we really need to answer a survey? Does anything else need to be said? So I took this survey.
It was kind of long, to be honest.
Yeah, it was.
It reminded me of like doing one for my grad school. Well, that's kind of what it was. It started by the poster Audible. Basically, he's just running a survey as part of his school training, and he says, feel free to pass it along. He basically shared it with the forum because there's some expectation that we're gamers. Anyone taking the survey gets a chance to answer questions pretending they're an elite gamer as possible, or otherwise trying to maximize an nerd factor.
Nice. It's
excellent.
Well, anybody who listens to the show is automatically an elite, so that's covered.
Yes.
This survey, it didn't have any time limit on it. The post didn't say it, and the survey itself doesn't say it. So, if you're listening to this episode in 2015, you can probably... It asks for some basic demographic information, such as your age, gender, and location, but they only ask for country in that case. They then ask if you're a casual gamer, a hardcore gamer, or don't know, with the helpful hint of, quote, there is no right or wrong answer, nor is there a given definition to follow, but just what you think, unquote. And... I teach your face is coming on here or something, but if you're going to have a survey and you're asking us to define ourselves, you really need to define it at least in terms of the survey to at least better your chances of getting people to respond the way that they should be. But anyway, I think anybody on here, we don't know. I selected don't know. No, I actually said hardcore gamer.
Yeah, I did too. Actually, that whole thing with the being clear is pretty important in these surveys. One of my classes that I had for my MBA program was market research. And man, did the professor come down hard on us. We were not clear with what our questions meant. And we had all these bias checks and everything, too, to make sure that our questions weren't leading our respondents to answer a certain way and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I was not impressed with them opening up with that question immediately and having it not be very clear, leaving it up to the person's judgment.
The number of games you bought in the past 12 months... Now, the thing with when I selected hardcore gamer, I said hardcore gamer because I'm hardcore into Civ 4, but my own definition, but actually I might be on the fence of actually putting myself in casual gamer simply again, some people would say, no, you're not a hardcore gamer. You're a hardcore Civ 4 player, Civ 4 gamer. If you were a hardcore gamer, you could be a strategy hardcore gamer, and anything that was strategy on the PC, you were really sinking your teeth into. But anyway, number of games bought in the past 12 months, which for me was only 2.
Dan is so not a hardcore gamer if he only bought 2.
I guess maybe I should even say 1.5. And a half might be too much of a credit, because it was Civilization IV Colonization. It was really an expansion pack.
That counts. It's a game. It's a game.
It's standalone, so I thought actually it was fair to say 2.
I forget already. Was there like a 3-5 option or something like that?
No, yeah, it was just the text field. You had to input a number.
Oh, okay. So I think I put 4. Like, I forget already what I put in the survey. I also listed myself as hardcore. I mean, I would have a hard time listing anything else. Like Civ 4, I would say I'm a little weaker at Civ 4 still than I would be at, for example, StarCraft or Warcraft 3, or even like the Madden NFL series. Probably, relatively speaking, better at those games against the average player than I am in Civ 4.
Mm.
Not a lot of TV, just video games for the most part.
What's TV?
You can watch TV and play at the same time.
Well, yeah, I'll have the TV on in the background sometimes, but it hurts my focus.
Then the next was, it was checkboxes, so all that apply on this survey. Buying games for self, family, partner, or don't buy.
They're mine, all mine.
Self.
Preferred platform, PC, console, portable. And what you had to do here is you had to rank them in order of 1, 2, 3. In my case, I actually went PC, portable, console. Well, except that Nintendo DS is a console, but it's portable. So did you mean by portable, like cell phone? The DS is a console platform.
Again, something that should have been defined survey as clearly, because if somebody's a casual gamer, how are they going to know the difference between those three systems? And that's just ridiculous.
Even I was kind of like, console, portable, there's some overlap there.
Yeah, well, I have a netbook I'm using right now to record the show, and that's portable, but it's a computer.
Yep, there you go. Prefer playing single player alone, single player with some others like passing pads or hot seat or helping out. Multiplayer in same room in competitive or cooperative mode, and multiplayer online in competitive or cooperative mode. And for me, I chose multiplayer in cooperative mode.
Yeah, co-op's a lot of fun in any game, you know.
You can do both. Cooperate with others competitively against others who also cooperate.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, of course, Civ 4 is such a complex game. It's hard just to easily say cooperative unless all your humans are on one team and there's no vassals.
The survey also asks you to list your 3 most favorite games ever, emphasis added.
Is it allowed to list like Beyond the Swords, then Warlords, then Vanilla?
I put Civ 4, Beyond the Sword, then StarCraft and Warcraft 3. Those are my favorite three.
I like too many genres.
Yeah, I got the same problem. Can I break it down for you, like top 3 by genre or something?
Yeah. Can I break it down by top 3 genre by decade?
Oh, that would also help.
So I listed Civilization 4, SimCity 3000, and Need for Speed Carbon. Said 3 favorite games ever. I was tempted to put Civilization, SimCity, Need for Speed, but they said games, not franchises, for instance, so I thought, fine, I'll be specific. Then you were given a number of multiple choice options of strongly agree, agree, disagree, or strongly disagree. There was no neutral on here. Ah, dear. See, on the next page, there were more multiple choice, and it was about your personality, and there was the 5th neutral category. These questions were about your gaming preferences, and there was no neutral. Now, I didn't make any notes of the multiple choice of personality because this isn't a psychology podcast. But some of the ones with the gaming ones, I found myself agreeing with most of these. I prefer games with big and complex worlds. I prefer games where I can conquer, explore, or commercialize.
Yeah, but I agreed for the most part also. These are things that are really general, like basic things that sound like they could be good ideas for games. So yeah, I mean, most people are going to agree with that.
This is all I prefer games where, for the most part, our preferences anyway, can make buildings and structures, games where I can manage resources, controlling multiple units. Now, I don't think Philip chose this one necessarily. Well, I mean, it's kind of random events, but it's more about some of the tactics involved in multiplayer, which is, I prefer games where events happen once I've finished my turn. You see, you can read that in a couple of ways. I thought about random events.
I didn't specifically mention that question when they had the stuff to mention at the end of the survey, but I kind of came down on this survey because of questions like that. What does that even mean? Events happen after my turn finishes? Basically, what they're saying is, I like turn-based strategy, because that's all that the question
apply to.
You can go any way with that question.
Yeah.
You could just be playing like Heroes of Might and Magic, and you end your turn, and the other people, they play their turn. That's an event. I mean, technically speaking, if you want to define an event,
yes,
another player taking their turn or attacking another city or something, those are all events. So I didn't disagree, because they didn't say anything about random events, where I would have like probably broke through the computer clicking on the strongly disagree button.
That's what I first thought of, actually, when I saw that was random events. Oh, I know what Philip's going to think of that.
I like how it come to mind immediately. They're like, people with, like, three posts in the forums, like, I'm not going to do a TMIT-style rant. I'm like, ah, great.
You're famous.
I prefer games with fast pace. Games that are carefully balanced by setting initial attributes comparably equal to all players. And then, how about, I prefer games with intelligent life. Well, we'd all like that. We've never seen it, but...
if you find one, let us know.
Multiplayer.
Intelligent life.
Yeah. You're missing that intelligent part. No, there's some good players online. That's true.
Have you responded accurately and honestly?
No, I just lied.
Well, if you're a liar, then of course you're going to lie in your answer now, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
I realize it's easy for people to circumnavigate this, but I just went back to the survey, and it will allow me to fill it out again, and my IP address is the same.
Yeah, I can too.
And then any other comments? I had to refer.
My comment is rewrite the survey a little better.
Well, he said he was doing it for Simon Fraser University School of Interactive Arts and Tech. But when we posted our surveys, we had the professor review them first. So, I mean, maybe that didn't happen here. But if it did, I'm a little underwhelmed, to be honest. Because that would reflect poorly on the school itself.
I like that any other comments question came after have you responded accurately and honestly, so I was tempted to put in any other comments. Your survey was damn good.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Runner in the Capitol. I replied to this thread. Sometimes it's a bit hard to know when to build a granary. Like, sometimes you just expand and then suddenly you got a lot of happiness and a lot of food and you just rip the granary before you start growing again. But sometimes you don't know when to build it. Like, if you want to whip settlers and workers beforehand, do you build a granary first or do you not?
I usually don't build granaries that often, but sometimes I build them when a city is young.
Oops.
Granaries are really, really important building in the city. The only limitation here is just initially you can't build a granary. You don't have fodder, and you can't build a granary until you get there. So then it becomes a question, is it going to be useful to you right away? And I think that depends on the game. I also struggle with this timing of the granary in the capital. Like, it feels like if you've got like a high seafood start and you're just going to be whipping constantly, then I might be inclined to build it a little. Or if I get something like two corns and a bunch of hills, you know, I'll just work those tiles, sit at pop 5 or 6 of charismatic, and just keep building settlers or workers. Because it's only useful for growing. It doesn't do anything unless you're either whipping and regrowing or just trying to grow to your cap. You're always going to grow to your cap when you get fodder and build your granary. One of your first builds, because it lets you work more tiles so much sooner. You might need a border pop, but after that, it's probably the next building that goes in.
Building granaries in other cities than the capital is usually very easy, because as long as you have access to the best tiles in your big fat cross through building culture or getting a monument or being creative, or they just are in the small part, then you want a granary. And if you have pottery, that's what you build.
By the time I have my second city, and by the time the monument is built in that city, I typically have pottery and I'm going granary right away. After that, but in your capital, I'd rather be spending the time whipping settlers and workers, and then after I've got 2, 3, 4 cities somewhere in there, I'm also having a look at the city screen for the capital, and I'm looking at the health, and if after I've got myself 3 or 4 cities and I'm established and they've got at least semi-decent protection given who my neighbors are and our disposition, then I will consider a granary. But only if I think there's going to be like a health issue, you know, in the media turns. And if it happens to be, oh, the city's going to grow, there's going to be some unhealthy here in 5 turns. What's going to take 7 turns to get the granary, a few turns on healthiness. Well, so be it. I mean, it's very situational in the game regardless. I will build it, but it is not a primary priority. It's a secondary priority.
Tend to consider it for the first few cities just because it helps the population come back faster from whipping, and cities that are kind of low on food so that when they do grow, it's not going to take them so long to grow. But after that, it usually only comes in if I need more health or something. Or if I'm the Inca, we should get terraces.
I always yell at Mackie because she doesn't build her granary soon enough.
I think it is wrong to not build granaries. Any city that is going to grow past size 6 will need a granary. Like, it pays for itself immediately if you whip it at size 4. If you're expansive, it's like growing past size 4, and then you want a granary.
I see your point.
I usually consider it a priority chop if I'm expansive.
Yeah.
So even in some cases where I could get the monument first, if I have a good pile in the first 8, yeah, I might build a granary first anyway.
Yeah, indeed.
But it is the number one economic building game, hands down. There's no more important building on average.
How about what to do with those great spies?
The answer is...
Try and settle it. Your total aggregate espionage from settling is almost always going to beat out building in Scotland Yard, unless you're deliberately running the slider. Put it in your capital. You're only getting 4 espionage from the palace, so it'll bump you to 8 at the turn. It's worth 4 espionage per turn without the slider in the early game. Whereas a settled one is like plus 12 espionage by itself. It's literally triple in terms of how good it is just for a straight espionage boost, unless you're using the slider. And on top of that, it offers back speakers as well. So if you're trying to get the espionage techs or other things sooner, it's also helping there.
Isolation, I rather want to save it for a golden age.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I 100% agree, especially if you have the crappy luck to have your first great person be a spy, which is, I think, one of the useless units in the early game.
It's really good for infiltrating someone that is close to you, and you have the holy city and the shrine of a religion, and they have that religion in their city but don't have that state religion, then you can get really huge multipliers by stealing technologies.
Oh my god, if you can line up all those things, it's absolutely ridiculous, as infiltration. Because an infiltration then will be like getting, I don't know, like 5 or 6 bulbs by itself. Because you can get like up to 80% espionage point reduction in theory. Like if you have the holy city and the opponents and open borders with you in different religion, stationary spy, not too far from your capital, all that garbage put together, it can get pretty insane.
Free technologies.
Yeah.
Because you get such a big ratio advantage against your opponent because they don't have any reliable means of generating espionage that early, or at least not in the kind of numbers that an infiltration gets. You also get a considerable percentage reduction just from having espionage point spending, so to speak. You have all like a 20%, 25% from that too. So if you bank up espionage on them and then spy bomb them, you can get quite a number of techs from them.
It should be worth to mention that even if not all the stars aligned, then bombing the spy is probably going to give you more than, say, a scientist bulb at that point in the game.
Depending on what your trades are. Well, that also is true for the spy, though. If you can steal tech and broker them, then it's going to be far and away the most beaker value thing you can do. But if you do something like bulb velocity, you can get pretty high returns on it, trading it around.
If they're far away, you can't effectively steal that much. You could, of course, steal, like, if you really have to destroy spaceships and stuff, then you can use espionage for that, but you can't really use it to steal technologies that's good.
I have trouble using it to destroy spaceship parts, because that's pretty expensive. And generally, if I can't do it militarily, that means I'm behind, and it's going to be hard to generate the espionage points and still actually tech decently myself.
Yeah, I guess.
It's screwing you over. Because someone will go cultural, someone will go space, maybe 2 of them will go space, and you're not going to be able to espionage take down both of their spaceship parts on the higher levels.
Unless you're going for, like, post-totic palace.
Well, yeah, but then space isn't an issue. You're going to win long before that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, for some reason, when I play, I'm not that big into espionage. I don't know why. Like, I might use it 2 or 3 times in a game, you know?
I remember playing in a pit boss where I ignore the espionage, and one other guy on my continent focused a lot of espionage in me and beat me with it. He stole rifling when I got rifling, he stole steel when I got steel, and then he destroyed my globe theater so I couldn't draft, and he drafted, and then I lost.
Generally, I don't get great spies. I usually don't build the wall. Maybe I get one later when I stop caring and the governor runs a spy specialist here and there and I get one.
They're almost invulnerable. They can move anywhere on the map and can't be seen. So you can spy with them, explore terrain of people that you don't have open borders with. They can be killed by nukes, and they don't swim home if they get destroyed while in a caravel.
But another great spy can't see him?
No.
That's why they're a great spy.
It's much more useful when people want to open borders with you. Like, the stupid AI always open borders with you, except if they're Tokugawa and you don't cuddle up to him. But in multiplayer, they don't open borders just because the option is there. So you can then spy with it.
I was playing an islands map where I bold astronomy in, like, 500 or 600 AD or something. And the first guy I meet, I'm like, will you open borders with me? He's like, yes. I'm like, I mean, I didn't say anything, but I was laughing to myself.
And those are not the people you're competing against. The people you're competing against are the people who don't open borders and whom your spy can explore.
State property or corporations from a Siver, double V, gotta pronounce it properly. He says, I'm having trouble deciding what would be more beneficial, quote unquote. And then he goes through a particular situation that he's in. I won't go into that specifically. I'll skip to the next point where he's being in more general terms, which is, quote, I'm worried that spreading corporations to more than a handful of cities will crash my economy. It seems more suited to a space win where you have a few super cities crank out parts with the extra production. State property seems more suited for a military win since it keeps costs of cities down and bumps production everywhere. How do you usually decide which route to go, quote unquote? And I liked Blitzkrieg's 1980s post of just simple formulas. Smaller empire plus cottage spam equaling definitely corporations. Multi-landmass empires plus hammer spam equals definitely state property, although I would amend the state property one to say you don't necessarily have to be multi-landmass, it could just be a huge landmass empire.
Actually, on a huge landmass empire, you have a lot of resources. Of course, it depends on the kind of resources you have, but if you have, like, say, 20 mining resources, then mining will definitely pay off in the long run. But if you're going for domination and you're almost there, then spending tons of hammers and gold on spreading a corporation now instead of just winning is stupid.
Well, corporations, I've noticed, are fun on games where I'm not going on domination. You can get a good monopoly going with one or two corporations. I believe that corporations at certain situations are profitable, very profitable.
Yeah.
The Deity Marathon space games, with few exceptions from what I've seen, well, for starters, they rush out like a ton of land with immortals from the start. But the vast majority of them use very high hammer mining ink, 40 hammer mining ink, as their basis for improving the research rate. And what they'll do is they'll just go factory forge power plant and then use those 40 base hammers building wealth and research with just a ton of cities. They don't need to build a whole lot of infrastructure before their cities turn around.
If there are a couple of really large empires in the game, and hopefully you're one of them, and you're trying to give yourself an edge, yeah, looking at what you've got, especially when it comes to mines, going for Mining Inc. could give you that edge that you need. So Blitzkrieg 1980 is, as I said, very general stuff, but you also got to be specific. We already talked about mining, like Mining Inc., for instance. But then you have to look at other corporations and what they require in order to give you some benefit.
Because with state property, you get workshops that are insane. You get 2 food, 4 hammers on a grassland, or 1 food, 5 hammers on plains. And it gets really a lot of production that way. But the problem with corporations is that they cost a lot of gold and a lot of hammers invested in a time in the game when you could be doing other things, like building an army to invade people. If you're going to stay for a long haul, which is space, or maybe sushi for culture.
Or milking score.
Yeah, you want corporations. If you're just going to win domination or playing multiplayer, that most usually want to go state property and just boost your production now instead of boosting your production 30 turns, 40 turns down the line.
There's one thing I don't see in this thread, and that's that this decision isn't made in the Renaissance where you have state property or corporations. This decision is made way before that. you have to plan for it one way or the other. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to just build some cottages that you're going to workshop over in a couple hundred years. You're deciding probably by the early ADs even, maybe before that, whether or not you're going to go with state property or corporations based on your land and what you want to do with the game. It's not always an easy decision to make, certainly. But it's not really touched on here what criteria you would use to go one way or the other.
Well, going state property can sometimes be very easy. If you don't have a lot of resources and you have a huge empire, then state property it is. The problem occurs when you have a huge empire, but you also have a lot of resources. Do you then go state property for the win, or do you go corporations for the long haul? That depends on the kind of game you're playing and what goals you have.
Do you agree that it would affect the tile improvements you're choosing to make earlier on?
Definitely.
I'm always looking at state property before I'm even entertaining corporations. State property is almost always something I'm going to be going for. Great people points. Overrated or underrated?
I don't think they're underrated. I think that they're added a little bit of power, you know. I like to go to my F1 menu and organize by points. That's the main reason I go to that menu. If the city that has the most points coming up is going to be the great person I want, do I need to move my specialist around?
Ah, there you go.
Is that how you manage your great people?
Yes, usually specialists.
You plan which city is going to produce the next one way before they start making great people points.
Well, you know, I agree with you there, and that comes down to, like, what wonder or what great person point producing thing you did. Like, for instance, what if I've got a prophet, and I've used my holy cities, and I don't really have any much use for the prophet anymore? I might want a scientist for them beakers, or an engineer even, you know? So I would want to twiddle around if I could.
Have you used your golden age yet? Let's see if I got another great prophet.
Yeah.
I used to underrate great people points, and then I saw people winning liberalism at like 200 AD or so, and I started rethinking that opinion. Learning how important a deliberate effort at great people points and getting them early can be, which is something where I'm still a little weak, admittedly.
You definitely need somewhere to generate some point early in the game, or you will be behind the people that do so.
What do you do when you have a situation where it's like your best great person city is one irrigated corn, or maybe like a fish? Like, you literally don't have any multi-food resource cities that you can settle. Or, like, maybe you got a fish and a grassland cow or something, but that's also your only good production city. I always struggle in situations like that.
You can always whip.
Having, like, a fish or a clam and a cow isn't a lot of food to start with. You're not going to be able to run a lot of great people there.
A fish, a clam, and a cow is actually a really good great person farm. I really like pigs in my great people farm.
Yeah, well, I do too. Anything that's 6 food is awesome, or any food tile is. But if you only have 4 food, then it's hard to run enough specialists.
But back to the question, he asked, what do you do if you only have, say, a fish, or a corn, or even an unirrigated wheat? What do you do? You just build a library, whip a library, and then run 2 scientists. You have to do it somewhere, and if that's the only place you can do it, then you do it there.
Now, do you use more than one city for that, then? Because if you're only running 2 scientists, you're not going to get them very quickly. The second one, you'll get it maybe early 500 BC mark. Or at least that's what's happening for me, where, like, I'll try to run some scientists early, I'll get my first great person, then it starts getting really slow after that. Unless I make a concentrated effort at literature, or I bold philosophy, switch to caste, or something like that.
The first and the second one will come, but after that, you need to look at other means. If you just have all the cities in the entire map are like this, then there's something wrong with the map. Odds are you haven't expanded far enough or conquered enough if you don't find any cities with more than one food resource.
It's hard to get more than that on Immortal or Deity. Well, it's hard to even get 8 on Deity.
Of course, but what you can do is start the Golden Age with, for example, the Great Person from Music, and switch to caste system and pacifism, and starve the cities. That will actually generate 2 or 3 more great people. When you're about to lose a population, it doesn't care how much negative food you have, so you can just assign everything in scientists, and then run 11 scientists for a turn. I've done this sometimes, but mostly when going for culture wins and generating the last artists.
Just to bring back to our last topic, with corporations, then you really got to be planning ahead for your great person.
An engineer for Mining Inc. isn't always easy.
No, not at all.
You just got to run one engineer in your great person farm all the game and hope that one of them will be an engineer.
You know, at the very least, you're getting a free, powerful accessory in your game. No matter what game you play, you're going to get great people, and they're going to be useful.
Not free, though.
Well, even if you're not paying attention to your great person points, you're going to get some eventually.
But the point is that you should pay attention, otherwise you are undervaluing them.
Well, I'm just saying, at the worst case scenario, they're still useful.
Yeah. So, are we talking about choking against the AI or against the humans here?
I think this threat was the AI, because it was an example where the player was using Sitting Bull, and he got one of his dog soldiers out really early, and he put it basically next to the AI's capital. The AI wouldn't even improve its fishing resources.
Yeah, the AI is really stupid, but that's not really a surprise.
Yeah, well, it's bad at everything, though.
Yeah.
Arguing that you shouldn't choke the AI because it's bad at choking is kind of like arguing that you shouldn't declare war on the AI because it's bad at war. Or, like, trade with it, because it's terrible at trading.
Yeah, but choking AI does have its uses. You wrote the thread about it, I think, Demean the team, that you can use a warrior that you put on a forested hill near an AI, and it won't expand against you. It will just sit in its cities and build archers and sometimes try to dislodge the warrior. And if you put an archer there in addition, it won't manage to do that, and it will just choke on itself and not expand enough.
Yeah, I've done a lot of really stupid stuff in the earlier game, testing out the AI. For example, last week I was doing some warrior rushes on Immortal, and it turns out you can, actually, without Inca. But that's besides the point. For choking, like, if you put the warrior right next to the city, it won't leave and settle other cities. But it will build up archers, and it will attack the warrior much sooner. Whereas if you put the warrior just, like, on the hill forest near their borders, they will expand, they'll improve their tiles, they'll do all of that. But they'll favor a direction away from you. So obviously you get some extra time to expand at the cost of having to defend yourself against stray units and hurting diplomacy and potentially opening yourself up to dogpile war, since the threshold for a dogpile is lower than total war or partial war. But you do get the potential for extra expansion room. And there's obviously the basic strategic considerations for chokes too. If you choke the AI, is some other AI just going to come and take your land? And then choking isn't nearly as good as if you get to take the land. And it is a bit of a balancing act to choke and expand and still protect yourself from barbarians all at once.
If you're alone with another AI, then choking is definitely an option. But if there are other people, especially in the same direction that that AI is in compared to you, then it might be better to do other things than choking it.
Well, Izo, you're more experienced in multiplayer. I mean, I've just started doing GameSpy a little bit more frequently in the last couple of weeks, and I've gotten better, but you're much more familiar with the multiplayer landscape. I've kind of copied what Unconquered Sun was saying about choking with longbows and feudalism with guerrilla, and it's pretty ridiculous against inexperienced players. They'll just leave, like, two archers garrisoned in their capital or something stupid when you have five longbows lurking around. But what's your general experience with choking in multiplayer?
Well, I usually just play Pit Boss, so it's often much bigger amounts of land per player, so choking is not that big an issue. I don't play on GameSpy or Ladder.
I found it incredibly difficult to war against other humans once Seed starts coming into play. This is just ridiculous. Anytime you enter their territory, they get to pick when they're hitting you with their Siege. So anything that has two movement points that kind of gets around that, or just units that spread them out, seem to help out a lot.
Yeah, but I think when people talk about choking, they usually mean the very early choke with, like, warriors and then archers, and then if it's axes and immortals and chariots, then it's usually an attack and not or a rush and not actually a choke.
I've seen some attempted axe rushes turn into chokes, though. Well, I've been on both ends of those, actually. People underestimate just how many units can be produced in quick speed.
Yeah,
the guy declares war on me, I have three archers in my capital, he has 11 units. But by the time he gets to my capital, I have 9 or 10 units in my capital. And I was fortunate he was stupid enough to attack that. There's just no way he was going to win more than a couple battles. But he did, so I turned it around.
Yeah, then you don't end up getting choked. But if you end up being choked in that position, then he can just wait for catapults and eventually you will succumb to all the catapults.
Yeah, but if they pillage your tiles, it's hard to do anything.
Yeah, that's what I meant, that if they pillage your titles and they have metal and you just have archers, then you're going to die.
Done. Unless somebody backstabs them in Prano, you're kind of screwed.
Yeah.
Work in forests is not a very good way to produce units to defend yourself.
Another good point about choking against the AI. They often render units stupidly around. If you threaten one city, they will run the units to protect that, and then you can often kill the units while they run there.
Yeah, the AI is coded. It'll produce units that are fixed garrison units. They never move. And then there's these units, I don't know what the code's called, but they'll shift it. Like, the AI uses it defensively, but it moves them around, and those guys are sitting ducked. Usually the only things that are fixed garrison units are like 2 or 3 archers per city, depending on the AI. Sometimes more if it's somebody like Sitting Bull, who just loves spamming units and sucking in general. And then you have your offensive stack, and it has one of the guys programming for better AI said that city attack, that script is actually for siege that the AI uses defensively, albeit poorly and standard Beyond the Sword AI, but it does use it, where it'll hit you with like 3 or 4 catapults when you get near a city. That's what you're seeing from city AI attack. So yeah, using units with 2 moves can really mess up the AI, because it'll start running its units everywhere.
Against humans, units with 2 moves are even better than against the AI, because the humans don't have these huge production bonuses, so they can't build decks that are 3 times your size. So if you send in 10 horse archers and threaten both of their cities, then they can't protect both of them.
Yeah, that's true. And then you can just burn them. You're not going to hold it. That doesn't matter.
Drafting. Dirty Parrot. So I read the drafting guide in the War Academy, and I have to admit that I don't feel like I can conceptualize well enough the impact of drafting. I play on Monarch, although I usually win most of my games. I'm a total noob in terms of Civ concepts, but drafting Rush By is almost a completely foreign concept to me, and I figure I should learn to implement. And then he asks a series of 3 questions. How does one recognize a good drafting site as opposed to it being a great person farm site? Can anyone give me an idea of the scope that drafting has on quickly building an army? Maybe the Mian team can do another Let's Play Civ 4 video using drafting. I had to mention that. And how viable is it for a small empire? Well, Philip's not going to be able to answer any part of that question because now he has to go make a drafting Let's Play Civ 4 video. He decided he's going to start on that right now. So for the rest of us...
You know how much I'd like to be able to do that? That's like one of the things that I'm planning on doing as soon as I upgrade my computer. It's been a long time since I've been able to do a Let's Play.
I admit I use drafting almost completely for defensive purposes. I'm sure there's stuff I could learn to have it used more on offense, but it's been a defensive thing for me. And not that often.
I like the combo with draft and airport. That's a great combo.
That's very late in the game.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I don't think there's a whole lot of difference between a good drafting site and a good great person farm site, other than choosing one or the other. Because obviously you need max food in either case.
Yeah, well, in a good drafting site, it's the same as a great person farm, but a great person farm is often more important. Getting these great people out that we talked about earlier is very important for your economy, while drafting is probably the strongest food to hammer conversion mechanic in the game.
The maces, musket men, and especially rifles, excellent. Especially in the case of the rifle, it's just ridiculous. Probably can't match any other way, with the only limitation being the unhappiness, of course.
Infantry is the same as macemen. And they're both better than mech infantry.
For small empires, it might be one of the only methods, especially in high levels, where you can keep up with the AI production. I know in Snatty's guide for Emperor Plus, he mentioned drafting as one of the ways to produce a lot of units. And I've also seen Unconquered Sun mention it a number of times, where if you have a small empire, just drafting like crazy, you know, running the slider however much you need to capture the land you need to compete.
It's the culture slider.
You can get a lot of units very quickly. If you're willing to bear the unhappiness, 30 rifles in 10 turns after you hit rifling is pretty impressive. It's not easy to produce that many units any other way, at least not in the time frame where drafting's at its best. I mean, sure, later in the game you get casts in guilds and workshops or something, or maybe mining ink, and you can put out a unit per turn in each city that's specialized for hammers. But just when you hit rifling, it's going to be very hard to keep up with just straight drafting. I mean, certainly you can complement that. You know, maybe whip out some cannons or produce some cannons or whatever else. Or spies to drop defenses.
Yeah, that's usually 2 to 3 times as much production as you normally would have without drafting. But it should be mentioned that while drafting might be good for small empires to break out and become bigger, drafting is much better at larger empires than it is for smaller empires. If you have a large enough empire, you can draft everywhere and you hardly feel the unhappiness because every city just gets drafted once.
And in a larger empire, you're also likely to have more resources, including happiness resources.
Mm-hmm.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
That's 44-121-288-POLY. You can Skype us at the Polycast.
Or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Here, have a tech. Now you won't declare war on me, ever.
You hope.
You know the AI personalities, you can know for a fact whether or not they will declare on you at a given disposition. Or if their disposition variance against you versus somebody else is enough that they will always declare on the other AI before they would declare on you. Like, if you know the war mechanics and you know the XML definitions for the leaders, then you absolutely can guarantee your safety with just Diplo in most cases. And if you spawn X a Shaka, okay. No, you're not going to be able to do it because you won't have enough time. But generally speaking, you can.
Discovering goodies on a mine.
Well, I can't remember the last time I dug a mine and I got some gems out of it, that's for sure. I have the worst luck with my mines.
1/10,000 per resource per turn per mine.
No wonder I don't get it then. So any turn, any mine could turn into a gem?
Or other metal resources as well.
Yeah.
Any resource that could pop, yeah. You could get coal or something too, once you know the tech. So you don't get a chance at coal until you know steam power.
Sometimes it's useful, other times it's not. Like, you're in the age of cavalry. You have discovered a source of copper!
Huzzah!
Yes, the one random event that can't be disabled. Sometimes it can have a really big impact on the game. You pop copper in your fat cross and, like, turn 30 or whatever, and all of a sudden, you play your game out a little different. You know, I've played a lot of games, so I've seen some ridiculous stuff. I had a capital with 3 irons that only started with 1 initially. So it can happen, it's just not very likely.
That's a lot of iron, though.
Yeah, it's very good production, all of a sudden.
Today, we have been joined with the Mian team.
Montian team has some stacks to say hello.
Oysar.
Goodbye.
Daniel Quick.
You've been joined by...
and Mackie.
Dan's just jealous he really wanted to be joined with you.
And of course, me as a guest, Tony Garrett-Sazaka Keel. Goodbye.
One, three, three, seven.
What does that stand for?
Leet.
Oh, really?
Oh, Tony, we have to explain that to you. Okay.
No,
Tony,
no.
Not, Tony's
no,
not.
No.
Tony's not.
Banned.
Fail.
Why does everyone keep telling me fail? I don't get it.
It's fail, not fail. Ah! Other than, like, stuff that I should not admit to having done... Maybe Dan will help me out. He can blackmail me, but keep it secret.
You want me to help you escape when they come for you? Well, try.
I was thinking more along the lines of not airing it, but you know, that helping me escape could be a possibility also.
You see, you had to define what help was, and now you've done that, so. You know, like you asked the question. Question mark, and you get male and female, and you get some answers like, hell yeah. So you gotta be specific. That water sound is making me think of other things.
I thought it was frying bacon.
Is he showering? All like that.
I thought he was showering.
As long as you are not cooking the bacon in the shower, which that would be an interesting trick, actually, then...
That sounds dangerous. How did we end up on this topic?
Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry.
Tangent.
And together with me as a guest is the me and the team.
Well, actually, he's the new...
I'm a regular co-host now, as of Polycast 76.
What, they hired you?
Yes, they were that desperate.
No, I'm joking. I don't know you that well, so I'm just totally joking. Pardon me. Did anyone mention I'm a dick? I'm sorry.
I thought you were Tony.
All right, that's going in the blooper room. Record date September 5th, 2009. Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright 2009, Civilized Communication at civcom.net.